Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading you from the February 6, 2026 issue of The Week. Our cover drawing this week looks like a cold city street scene. In the foreground, we have four different law enforcement officers all in tactical gear. We've got a regular police officer pointing a gun at the viewer, a couple of border patrol officers, and one that says police federal agent. They all have hats and masks on, and the one closest to us is spraying a can of pepper spray at the viewer. The headline is "License to Kill: Will Trump De-escalate After Another Fatal Shooting?" We get to that in a couple of spots, including our first main story. Trump tries to contain backlash over Pretty shooting. What happened? President Trump shook up the leadership of his Minneapolis immigration crackdown this week after federal agents sparked widespread outrage by fatally shooting protester Alex Pretty. Trump pulled out Gregory Bovino, the combative Customs and Border Protection commander who'd spearheaded the operation, after Bovino and other administration officials issued a string of false statements about the shooting that Pretty's family denounced as sickening lies. Cell phone video shows Petty, a 37-year-old ICU nurse with no criminal record, recording federal agents with his phone when an agent pushes a woman to the ground. Petty places himself between the woman and the officer, who sprays them both with a chemical agent. Officers then push down and strike Petty repeatedly. One agent removes a licensed pistol Petty was carrying in a waistband holster. After an officer shouts, "Gun!", two agents open fire, hitting Pretty 10 times. Despite that footage, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem claimed that the nurse had attacked officers, while Bovino and said Pretty wanted to massacre law enforcement. Trump aide and immigration hardliner Stephen Miller called Pretty a would-be assassin. Trump said he didn't like the shooting, but noted that Pretty's possession of a legal firearm doesn't play good either. The killing, which came 2 weeks after the fatal shooting of Minneapolis protester Renee Good, wrought widespread horror. Some Republican lawmakers called for a full investigation and beseeched Trump to lower the temperature. "There needs to be a pivot in the whole operation," said Representative Mark Amodi, Republican from Nevada. Promising to de-escalate a little bit, Trump replaced Bovino, whom he called a pretty out there kind of guy, with border czar and Noem critic Tom Homan. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey met with Homan, who called their meetings a productive starting point. Trump's conciliatory stance lasted only a few hours. In a speech in Iowa, he called anti-ICE demonstrators paid insurrectionists and later posted online that Frey was playing with fire, after the mayor said his city does not enforce federal immigration law. In Minneapolis, immigration raids and clashes between agents and protesters continued. What the editorial said: Pretty's horrendous killing is a new low point in an immigration offensive that's become a moral and political debacle for the Trump presidency, said the Wall Street Journal. Pretty made a tragic mistake by interfering with federal agents, but that warranted arrest, not a death sentence. This calls for a rethinking by Trump, who must pursue a less provocative strategy. "What we need is a pause in ICE's operations," said the Minnesota Star Tribune. The administration's claim that it is targeting violent migrants has collided with on-the-ground reality. Fear rippling through neighborhoods, business disrupted, a city that increasingly feels under siege, and two dead U.S. citizens. Homan has his work cut out for him, said the Washington Post. "The first step is to refocus on operation that Americans were told would target the worst of the worst. Instead, federal agents have been running dragnets through immigrant neighborhoods, ripping children from their parents, and rounding up nannies, maids, and gardeners. Homan can't erase the mistakes of the last month, but he can right this ship if White House hardliners will let him. What the columnist said. What's happening in Minneapolis is a campaign of state terror, said M. Gessen in the New York Times. Federal agents have smashed car windows and dragged out U.S. citizens, pulled a grandfather from his home in his underwear, forcibly entered homes without judge-signed warrants, and beaten and sprayed immobilized protesters with tear gas. And the administration has told us all not to believe what we can see with our own eyes. In short, Trump is using all the instruments deployed by tyrants such as Hitler and Stalin, random violence by paramilitary force, and executions followed by vilification of the victims. Trump's stunning course shift came after anxious Republicans raised alarm, said Annie Linsky in the Wall Street Journal. Insiders say Trump allies convinced him the chaos in Minneapolis was a political liability and that the overaggressive deportation effort was squandering support for his signature campaign issue. Even before Preddy's death, 61% of respondents in a New York Times poll, including 71% of independents, said ICE had gone too far. The victory here belongs to the thousands of ordinary citizens who resisted, said Adam Serwer in The Atlantic. They showed up at protests in sub-zero temperatures, delivered supplies to immigrant families hiding in fear, and like Preddy and Good, joined ICE watch patrols at considerable personal risk. In doing so, they defied a series of mistaken MAGA assumptions that liberals are adept at virtue signaling but crumble when tested, and that diverse communities are weak by definition. The multiracial community in Minneapolis was supposed to shatter. It did not. This battle isn't over, said Alex Shepard in the New Republic. Trump saw he was presiding over a disaster and knew something had to change. But all we're getting in Homan is a different corrupt person in charge, just one he hopes is less murderous. In the long run, MAGA can't actually win this fight, said Ross Barkin in New York, but it can do inordinate damage as it loses. The Trump regime is weak, but the weak are still dangerous, and there is more darkness waiting before dawn. Controversy of the week. Greenland, the lasting damage of Trump's tantrum. So, was it worth it? Asked Judson Berger in National Review. The long saga of President Trump's fixation with owning Greenland appeared to end last week with a merciful whimper. In a rambling address to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, Trump not only withdrew his previous threats to annex Greenland through military force, but also announced the cancellation of threatened tariffs against European nations who had opposed his plans to purchase the vast semi-autonomous island from Denmark. Instead, said Trump, he and NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte had hammered out the framework of a deal with respect to Greenland. Trump claims the vague, still unwritten deal will allow the construction of his dubious Golden Dome missile defense system, enable American companies to pay for licenses to mine Greenland's minerals, and include pockets of U.S. sovereignty around an expanded number of military bases. That last claim is unconfirmed, said Douglas E. Schoen in The Hill, but the U.S. already had full military and commercial access to Greenland under a treaty signed in 1951. We've gained nothing we didn't already have, while Trump's shock and awe tactics have weakened NATO, emboldened Russia and China, and inflicted immense long-term damage to America's geopolitical, economic, and security interests. Typically, Trump is framing his U-turn as a triumph of hardball negotiation. said Isaac Stanley Becker and Jonathan Lemire in The Atlantic. But the reality is that Europe got Trump to cave on Greenland. Domestic politics, no doubt, also played a role. 86% of Americans oppose invading a NATO ally, and even some usually supine congressional Republicans denounced Trump's expansionist ambitions. But the real pressure came from Europe, which responded to Trump's bullying with steely, united defiance. A joint reconnaissance mission to Greenland by troops from 8 European nations reportedly rattled Trump, as did a plunge in the U.S. stock market after the EU started selling U.S. bonds and threatened new retaliatory tariffs. European disgust with the U.S. will long outlive Trump's presidency, but the real lesson of Trump's Greenland climb down is that, as one EU official put it, Europe is learning to bully back. So maybe Trump isn't an all-powerful dictator after all, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The liberal media has insisted that second-term Trump is rampaging Frankenstein's monster, unchained to do whatever he wants. Yet now they also tell us he abandoned his designs on Greenland under pressure from public opinion, markets, allies, and fellow Republicans. Which is it? The reality is that despite his over-the-top style, Trump remains a Democratic leader in a constitutional republic, constrained by the same forces as any president. Is sanity one of those constraints? Asked David French in the New York Times. Trump's conduct was demonstrably irrational, from claiming he had a psychological need to own Greenland to the deranged and delusional letter he sent Norway's prime minister, threatening to invade Greenland because your country decided not to give me the Nobel Peace Prize. In a healthier democracy, said Michael Hicks in the Muncie, Indiana Star Press, Trump's unhinged behavior would be grounds for impeachment or removal from office under the 25th Amendment. But in our dysfunctional country, all that decent Americans can do is feel ashamed of our president and our nation. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It's a good week for snowbirds. After Senator Ted Cruz, who famously absconded to sunny Cancun before an ice storm slammed Texas in 2021, was spotted boarding a flight to Laguna Beach, California, as Winter Storm Fern approached his home state. Cruz later said he was visiting California on a work trip, unrelated to the weather. It was a good week for Greenland. After the same disturbance in the polar vortex that brought frigid temperatures and snow to much of the U.S., created balmy weather for the Danish territory. In the capital, Nuuk, the high reached 48 degrees, 24 degrees above normal. It was a good week for just asking questions. After conspiracy theorist Candace Owens, posting on X, demanded to know why the temperature is 30 degrees, but the ice on our treetops is not melting at all. Some of Owens' followers blamed secret government geoengineering programs. Others noted that 30 degrees is below 32 degrees, water's historical freezing point. It was a bad week for transparency after Lululemon temporarily paused online sales of its Get Low leggings after customers complained that the pants become see-through when stretched. In a statement, the athleisure brand said it was working to improve its product education around the leggings, but expects to resume sales shortly. It was a bad week for Homo sapiens. After a warning from biologists that mosquitoes in Brazil are developing a clear preference for feeding on humans, researcher Sergio Machado said that as deforestation shrinks the animal population, mosquitoes are forced to seek new alternative blood sources. Finally, it was a bad week for Bill Belichick. Winner of 6 Super Bowls as head coach of the New England Patriots, who was not voted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in his first year of eligibility. Sources told ESPN that the surly Belichick was snubbed over the Spygate and Deflategate cheating scandals. the title of this week's briefing is The Price of Forgiveness, President Trump's unprecedented use of pardons has turned clemency into a big business. How many people has Trump pardoned? A year into his second term, President Trump has issued more than 1,700 acts of clemency, both pardons that fully erase federal convictions and commutations that lessen sentences. In his entire first term, he issued 238. Trump's clemency spree began on his first day back in office when he granted clemency to nearly 1,600 people convicted or charged in connection with the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, including rioters who assaulted police with flagpoles and bear spray. Since then, he has issued clemency at an unprecedented clip, forgiving fraudsters, donors, drug lords, and minor celebrities. They include former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, convicted of conspiring to traffic more than 400 tons of cocaine to the U.S., Ross Ulbricht, founder of the dark web drug bazaar Silk Road, private equity exec David Gentile, who ran a $1.6 billion Ponzi scheme, and Adriano Comberos, a California fraudster who received clemency in Trump's first term for a separate financial crime. Most recipients have styled themselves as victims of lawfare and a weaponized Biden-era Justice Department. Some have paid Trump World insiders and consultants to campaign for clemency and have invested in Trump family businesses. Justice Department pardon attorney Ed Martin, a vocal defender of Trump's bogus claims of fraud in the 2020 election, says a common philosophy guides all decisions. No MAGA left behind. Is this how the process is supposed to work? Not according to the founders. The president's pardon power, enshrined in the Constitution and rooted in English King's ancient prerogative of mercy, was initially conceived as a relief valve in cases of unjust prosecution or convictions. The president needed the power to make exceptions to the law for unfortunate guilt, Alexander Hamilton wrote in 1788, lest the justice system become too sanguinary and cruel. Hamilton thought the power was especially useful in seasons of insurrection or rebellion, when the speedy granting of mercy by the president, without the need for debate in Congress, would help restore the tranquility of the Commonwealth. President George Washington issued the first pardons in 1795, saving two men sentenced to hang for treason over their involvement in the Whiskey Rebellion. The misled, Washington said, have abandoned their errors. What did other presidents do? Most used the power sparingly, and typically issued grants at the end of their term to avoid controversies that could swamp the day-to-day business of governance. There have been exceptions. Andrew Johnson issued a blanket pardons for all Confederate soldiers and officials in 1868 in an attempt to heal the wounds of the Civil War. Other presidents deployed clemency as a corrective for crimes no longer considered serious, such as Jimmy Carter granting amnesty to 200,000 Vietnam draft dodgers, and Joe Biden to thousands of people convicted of marijuana possession. But the use of clemency for political and seemingly personal reasons increased sharply in the past half century, with the turning point being the 1974 pardon of former President Richard Nixon by his successor and former Vice President Gerald Ford, a month after Nixon resigned over the Watergate scandal. In 2001, Bill Clinton pardoned Democratic donor and fugitive financier Mark Rich. In 2007, George W. Bush commuted the sentences of vice presidential aide Scooter Libby. And in his final weeks of office, President Biden pardoned his son Hunter for gun and tax evasion charges and issued a string of preemptive pardons to protect family members and officials from retribution by the incoming Trump administration. Those decisions smacked of nepotism and favoritism, said Kimberly Will, a law professor at the University of Baltimore. But clemency under Trump has become an instrument of corruption. Is there evidence of corruption? A A new pardon shopping industry has emerged, with lobbyists telling the Wall Street Journal that their going rate is $1 million. Crypto exchange Binance paid about $800,000 to lobbyists to secure clemency for its founder, Changping Zhao, who pleaded guilty in 2023 to enabling money laundering. Trump pardoned him in October, saying he had no idea who Zhao was. He didn't mention that Binance has done billions of dollars in business with World Liberty Financial, the Trump family's main crypto firm. Paul Walczak, convicted of evading more than $10.9 million in federal taxes while running a health care empire, was pardoned in April, just a month after his mother attended a $1 million fundraiser for Trump. Other pardons have been issued to political allies, such as Trump's former personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and others accused of trying to overturn the 2020 election, and to reality TV couple Julie and Todd Chrisley, whose daughter Savannah is a vocal presence in the magosphere. The power to pardon is being totally and thoroughly politicized, said Liz Oyer, who was fired as U.S. pardon attorney last year after she refused to reinstate the gun rights of Trump-backing actor Mel Gibson. It's turning into a benefit for those who are supporters of the president and not for those who do not express political loyalty. What are the consequences of that change? Victims of those granted clemency by Trump say they are being denied justice, and often financial compensation. When Trump commuted the sentence of Ponzi schemer Gentile, he also declared that the fraudster will not have to pay the $15.5 million in restitution associated with his conviction. It is disgusting, said Carol Ann Tutera, 70, who invested more than $400,000 with Gentile's company. I have to keep working to make up for what I was owed. Many other victims will likely never see a cent. The criminals pardoned by Trump in his first year owed more than $298 million in fines and restitution. This degradation of the pardon system will incentivize and entrench both political and corporate corruption, warns Casey Michael, a kleptocracy specialist at the Human Rights Foundation. How stupid a corporate leader do you have to be, he said, to continue complying with rules and regulations that are no longer even enforced. And time for a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. An Orwellian federal database. The Trump administration has been collecting a vast amount of data on Americans that can be weaponized against perceived enemies, said Catherine Rampell. Ostensibly in the name of public safety, the authoritarian administration now has drawn up lists of immigrants, lists of people with developmental disabilities, list of dissidents, and lately, even lists of Jews. Trump recently sued the University of Pennsylvania, demanding the records of all Jewish faculty, staff, and students to help the government combat anti-Semitism on college campuses. UPenn refused, but Barnard College gave in, and the shocked faculty received government questionnaires asking if they were Jewish. Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, has said he plans to create a database of people who protest ICE operations by snapping photos of the demonstrators and IDing their cars. The whistleblower recently said that Doge copied Social Security data and gave it to a political group trying to overturn election results in several states. Documents indicate the National Institutes of Health may be pursuing a disease registry of people with autism. As the federal government aggressively expands its Orwellian database, do you feel safer yet? Newsom's weighty baggage. California Governor Gavin Newsom's pivot to the center may be too late for 2028, said Mark Novikoff and Jonathan Chait. Many progressives view Newsom as the favorite for the Democratic presidential nomination, thanks to his roguish charisma, his relentless mockery of President Trump, and his recent ideological flexibility. As he moves to the center to make himself more nationally electable, Newsom has embraced the abundance agenda promoted by progressive pragmatists and has criticized allowing trans girls and women to compete in women's sports. But throughout his tenure in California, Newsom has backed faddish progressive policies that won't play well in Midwestern swing states. Newsom has been far left on immigration, even expanding Medicaid to cover those who entered the country illegally. He's adopted progressive stances on affirmative action, crime, and reparations. The Democrats are likely to focus on affordability, but Newsom isn't well suited to deliver that message. The median home price in his state is nearly $1 million, and California has the most expensive gas in the continental United States. No matter how hard Newsom tries to reinvent himself, he carries too much liberal baggage to win a presidential election. This is an international column from Gaza. Abandoned by Trump's Board of Peace. President Trump's so-called Board of Peace is a betrayal of the Palestinian people, said Abdullah al-Sanawi. When the body was first announced last September, it was billed as a U.S.-led international council that would maintain security in Gaza and oversee its reconstruction following the two-year war between Israel and Hamas, a devastating conflict that killed more than 70,000 Palestinians and reduced the enclave to rubble. But when the board's founding document was unveiled last week, it included no mention of the Palestinian issue, nor did it refer to Gaza or any potential role for the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah. Instead, it declares that the board will focus on all of the planet's conflict zones, suggesting it has moved on to other shinier projects before even being tested in the besieged and starving Gaza Strip. When Trump does mention Gaza, he alludes to its enchanting coastline, a clear sign of his intentions to realize his dream of creating a Gaza Riviera, driving out its 2.1 million people under the guise of overseeing the ceasefire. This is a leap into the unknown, with Gaza's fate at the mercy of Trump's whims. The idea of internationalizing the Gaza peace process was one of the few promising aspects of Trump's original plan, said LeMond in an editorial. But rather than assemble a true board of peace, he's put together a board of sycophants and tyrants that he hopes will replace the United Nations. Among the first leaders offered membership were debtors like Argentine President Javier Milei, whose economy recently got a Trump-approved bailout, admirers like Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, and enemies of the West, such as Russian President Vladimir Putin. The organization itself will be overseen by an executive board that includes Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner and members of his own administration. Its only non-American member is former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair. This gives all the power to Trump, a man who has said that his only limit is his own morality. The UN has its problems, but this board is the worst possible alternative. None of this is good for Israel, said the Jerusalem Post in an editorial. The U.S. decision to push ahead with Phase 2 of the Gaza Peace Plan, which includes establishing the Board of Peace, crosses many of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's red lines. Gaza's Rafah border crossing is being opened, something Netanyahu insisted couldn't happen until Hamas disarmed, to boost aid deliveries from Egypt. And Qatar and Turkey, both of which are hostile to Israel, have agreed to join the Board of Peace. So Hamas supporters will now be put in charge of disarming the terrorists. We know how that is going to play out. The odds are long, but give Trump's Gaza vision a chance, said Ben-Dror Yemeni. Israel's fight against the terrorists behind the October 7, 2023 attack was the most justified war since the war against the Nazis. Yet we're in diplomatic freefall. Protests and boycotts continue against Israel, not against Hamas. Israel's only choice is to bite its lip and support the vision. If it succeeds, Gaza will be demilitarized. Israel certainly doesn't need to sabotage the process. Hamas knows how to do that on its own. And the last word, our feature article, also dealing with the ICE raids and the protest. Facing the ICE storm. The federal immigration crackdown in Minneapolis has united residents in outrage, said Robert F. Worth in The Atlantic. Will other communities follow their model of resistance? The six-car ICE convoy came to a stop, and instantly dozens of people swarmed it. Cell phones in hand, while others ran out of nearby houses. I saw a woman in gym shorts in the 20-degree weather and began surrounding the masked and heavily armed agents who had spilled out of their black SUVs. The fury in the crowd felt almost like a physical force, as real as the cacophony of whistles and honking cars and angry chants, "ICE out, F you, go home." The officers threw a protester into the slushy asphalt and piled on top of him, then cuffed him and dragged him away. The screaming only got louder. With their escape route blocked by protesters and their cars, the agents tossed out tear gas canisters, the white clouds billowing up into the winter air. An injured man stumbled past me and vomited repeatedly into the snow. From where I stood a few yards back from the January 21st scrum, it looked at best to be a savage caricature of our national divide. On one side, militarized men demanded respect at the butt of a gun. On the other, angry protesters screamed for justice. But behind the violence in Minneapolis is a different reality, a meticulous urban choreography of civic protest. You could see traces of it in the identical whistles the protesters used, in their chants and their tactics, in the way they followed ICE agents but never actually blocked them from detaining people. Thousands of Minnesotans have been trained over the past year as legal observers and have taken part in lengthy role-playing exercises where they rehearse scenes exactly like the one I witnessed. They patrol neighborhoods day and night on foot and stay connected on encrypted apps such as Signal, in networks that were first formed after the 2020 killing of George Floyd. Again and again, I heard people say they were not protesters, but protectors of their community, of their values, of the Constitution. Vice President J.D. Vance has decried the protest as engineered chaos produced by far-left activists working in tandem with local authorities. But the reality on the ground is both stranger and more interesting. The movement has grown much larger than the core of activists shown on TV newscasts, especially since the killing of Renee Good on January 7. And it lacks the sort of central direction that Vance and other administration officials seem to imagine. At times, Minneapolis reminded me of what I saw during the Arab Spring in 2011, a series of street clashes between protesters and police that quickly swelled into a much larger struggle against autocracy. As in Cairo's Tahrir Square, Minneapolis has seen a layered civic uprising where a vanguard of protesters has gained strength as many others who don't share progressive convictions joined in feeling, if not always in person. Overall, this community has exercised enormous restraint. Allison Sharkey, the executive director of the Lake Street Council, which represents many minority-owned businesses that have been hit hard by the ICE raids, told me, "But we have been pushed, probably intentionally, towards civil unrest." And as with the Arab uprisings, there is profound unease about where it is all leading, especially now that two people have been shot dead in scenes like the one I witnessed, alongside an undertow of hope that Minnesota can provide the rest of the country with a model of democratic resistance. Over the past year, a three-story brick building in South Minneapolis has become the magnet for people who feel they and their neighbors need protection from their own government. The nonprofit that runs training sessions there asked me not to identify its location. When I visited, an ebullient labor organizer named Emilia Gonzalez Avalos was standing on stage in front of a packed auditorium, talking about facial recognition technology used by ICE agents who routinely photograph protesters. "Everyone is at risk now," she said. Behind her, a screen offered bullet points on how to legally observe ICE raids. Avalos told me that 65,000 people have received the training, most of them since December. "We started in a very different tone. It was preventive," she said. "Now, after Good's death, people are understanding the stakes in a different way." The nonprofit groups that run these training sessions are not organizing or directing the anti-ICE protests taking place in the Twin Cities. No one is. The people who follow ICE convoys have organized on a neighborhood basis, using signal groups. It's visible to anyone walking through Minneapolis. On a bitterly cold morning, I approached a man standing across the street from an elementary school, a blue whistle around his neck. He told me that he stood watch every morning for an hour to make sure the kids got into school safely. Other local volunteers come by regularly to bring him coffee and baked goods or to exchange news. These community watches take place outside schools throughout the Twin Cities, outside restaurants and daycare centers, outside any place where there are immigrants or people who might be mistaken for them. Inside the schools, many administrators have been making their own preparations over the past year. Amanda Bauer, a 49-year-old teacher at a Minneapolis elementary school that has a large portion of immigrant students, struggled to maintain her composure as she described the day early this month when ICE showed up in force outside her school. Agents had been circling the school since December, seemingly learning its routines, and they arrested some parents just before the winter break. But this time, agents leaped out in riot gear and began entering the apartments just across from the school, where many students live. "We had to lock down and keep the kids inside, and parents linked arm to block the school entrance," Bauer said. "We had a student who was looking out the window and saw them break into his apartment and just sobbed, 'That's my house. That's my home.' And we shut the blinds, but it was too late." Bauer has been a teacher for 25 years, a period that has included a rise of school shootings and the drills that have become common to protect against them. "But I never thought it would be our own government we had to protect the kids from," she told me. "We kept them physically safe, but they saw what happened." As she spoke, Bauer's hands were trembling. She held them up and smiled weakly. "I don't think I've stopped shaking for 2 weeks," she said. Children were a moral fault line for many of the people I met in the Twin Cities. A couple in their 70s, Dan and Jane, like many others they asked that I shield their full names, told me they had never considered joining a political protest until ICE came to town, and they realized that their granddaughter was at risk of witnessing a violent immigration raid just by going to school. "When a child witnesses violence or crime, it's profoundly different from adults," Dan says. "It leaves scars." Dan and Jane resisted the idea that they had become political. A better word, Jane said, was humanist. Their anger was unmistakable as they told me that the Trump administration was violating basic Christian principles. It became clear very quickly that ICE is the Proud Boys, the Boogaloo Boys, Dan said. They've given them uniforms and let them run wild. I arrived in Minneapolis 11 days after an ICE agent shot Good in the face. Her picture was hanging like a religious icon on windows and walls all over the city. To many who had not already become involved, her death was a call to action. One of those latecomers was a 46-year-old documentary filmmaker named Chad Knutson. On the morning after Good was killed, he was at home watching a live feed from the Whipple Building, where ICE is based, a 5-minute drive from his house. A protester had laid a rose on a makeshift memorial to Good. As Knutson watched, the ICE agent took the rose, put it in his lapel, and then mockingly gave it to a female ICE agent. They both laughed. Knutson told me he had never been a protester, but when he saw those ICE agents laughing, something broke inside him. "I grab my keys, I grab a coat, and drive over," Knutson told me. "I barely park my car, and I'm running out screaming and crying. You stole a effing flower from a dead woman. Like, are any of you human anymore?" He now goes to the Whipple Building almost daily, bringing thermoses of hot coffee for the people who hold up signs and bellow at the ICE agents and convoys as they drive in and out. "He has been tear gassed so many times," he said, "his voice has gone hoarse." He mentioned in passing that his neighbor had an adopted brown kid down there. They hid her in the basement yesterday. This kind of thing no longer sounds weird in Minneapolis. Many people are hiding indoors, so many that in a city with a substantial minority population, I hardly saw any black or Latino faces on the street. All this sheltering has created an economic crisis that has grown worse by the day. Many immigrant-owned businesses have seen their sales drop by as much as 80%, said Sharkey. The Carmel Mall, a maze-like shopping hub for tens of thousands of East African immigrants in the Twin Cities, is usually packed with people drawn to the aromas of stewed goat and coffee and sambusa pastries. But when I visited, the place was silent, and most of the stalls were empty. Several people looked frightened when I tried to ask questions, saying they didn't speak English well or that the owner would be back in an hour. One man willing to chat, a 42-year-old named Ziad, who was sipping coffee by himself, quickly showed me his passport card, saying he had come to the U.S. from Somalia decades ago. He had a master's degree in public health and was working in a community center, he said, but now it's closed. His children are attending school online, as they did during the coronavirus pandemic, and his wife almost never leaves home. The visits to the mosque and to family members and friends that sustain their emotional lives are on hold. "But Donald Trump will go and we will stay," he said. "We Somalis know how to survive. We've been through a lot. Civil war, refugee camps." The Somali refugees who began coming to the Twin Cities in the early 1990s did so with the help of religious organizations and churches, especially Lutheran and Catholic parishes that have a history of welcoming people fleeing war and famine. Those groups have been at the forefront of the resistance to ICE, and some of their leaders have been asking difficult questions. When does protest cross the line into violence? When is it morally acceptable to break the law? How do you retain the trust of people who are uncomfortable defying the authorities? "We're going to have to live with our discomfort in making other people uncomfortable," Ingrid Rasmussen, the lead pastor at Holy Trinity Lutheran Church, who has been one of the most outspoken clergy members in the city, told me. Rasmussen's church was near the center of the riots that took place after the killing of George Floyd in 2020. "Everything to the west of our building burned," she told me. During that period, her church became a medical site for injured people. She and her congregation worked for years to help rebuild the neighborhood. The new round of ICE raids has struck even closer to home for the church, whose congregation includes a large number of immigrants. Rasmussen, who has young children, has continued to put herself in harm's way. On January 23rd, she was among those arrested during the protest at the Minneapolis airport. On the morning of January 24th, Rasmussen got word that a man had been shot by ICE agents. She put on her warmest winter clothes and went to the scene, figuring she might be outside for hours. By the time she got there, Alex Preddy, an ICU nurse, was dead. The federal agents who had wrestled him to the ground and then shot and killed him were throwing tear gas and flashbangs at a crowd of furious protesters, shouting, "Shame!" Rasmussen attended another protest that afternoon. When we spoke hours later, her voice sounded weary, as if she wasn't sure what such gestures of defiance would accomplish. She found it almost unbearable to witness such brutality from her own government day after day, she told me, and it was galling to hear people in power say that they were acting in defense of freedom. The street still looked like a war zone, with flashbangs detonating and clouds of tear gas in the air. This was adapted from a story originally published in The Atlantic. Here's an article on the business page, News at a Glance. Social media mental health reckoning begins. Social media is going on trial, said Maria Curie and Ashley Gold in Axios. Jury selection began this week in a landmark case in Los Angeles County Court that will see Meta and YouTube defend themselves against claims their platforms deliberately addict and harm young people. One of the plaintiffs, identified in court documents as KGM, alleges her social media addiction led to depression, anxiety, and body dysmorphia. Meta chief executive Mark Zuckerberg is expected to testify February 9th. The trial is seen as a bellwether that could determine how thousands of similar lawsuits could play out nationwide, including one in federal court set to begin in June. Hours before the court proceedings started, TikTok moved to settle, joining Snapchat, which settled last week. It's hard to dispute a population-level link between teens getting access to social media in the late 2000s and the subsequent increase in psychological problems, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, especially among girls. That said, proving causation in court is extremely difficult. The plaintiff, KGM, for instance, was also exposed to domestic abuse in her home as a young child, which may have made her more vulnerable to content on the platforms. Social media companies should have Section 230 protections, which prevent them from being liable for user content. But if Congress and states think they need to do more to protect kids, they can pass legislation. Here's an interesting little piece on the health and science page. I wish you could see the picture of it that goes with it. A bovine with a back scratcher. And yes, she's got the a brush in her mouth and scratching herself. A cow in Austria has been recorded doing something never previously documented in her species, reports the Washington Post, using a tool. Veronica, a 13-year-old brown Swiss who is kept as a pet, was filmed picking up a long-handled brush, gripping it in her mouth, and deliberately rubbing the bristled end along her back to scratch an itch. In a series of field trials, she repeatedly repositioned the brush, using her tongue and teeth, even switching ends to use the smooth handle to gently rub delicate areas such as her udders and belly. This behavior wasn't trained, leading researchers to conclude that the cognitive abilities of cows, which humans have lived alongside for thousands of years, may be underestimated. Study co-author Antonio J. Osuna Moscaro says other brainy bovines have since come to light, suggesting all cows might develop similar skills if they were given long and idyllic life Veronica has enjoyed. Our conclusion is that Veronica is not special, he says. What is special is the conditions that Veronica has. In one of the technology articles, AI, Dr. ChatGPT will see you now. If you want to know where artificial intelligence is headed, visit a hospital, said Tiping Chen and Chow Ding in the Wall Street Journal. Healthcare has become the proving ground for widespread AI adoption. Among health systems, 27% are currently paying for commercial AI licenses, triple the rate across the U.S. economy. It's helping doctors and administrators take notes, field phone calls, and deal with insurance claims. And it is starting to aid in giving health advice. A study last year found that AI was better able to identify subtle signs of breast cancer than human radiologists. Doctors still make medical decisions, but patients are increasingly turning to chatbots over clinics. OpenAI recently lost ChatGPT Health, enabling AI to zip through medical records and wellness apps for a more personalized medical response, said Ina Fried in Axios. More than 40 million people a day already turn to ChatGPT with health questions, the company said, and ChatGPT is available 24/7. This has the potential to backfire spectacularly, said Parmi Olson in Bloomberg. Google attempted something similar in the late 2000s under the banner Google Health, which could aggregate a person's medical data from different doctors and hospitals. But people were creeped out at the idea of uploading their health records to a company that regularly hoovered up personal information for ads. AI healthcare has a different problem. Companies haven't proved yet that their models are free from hallucinations. We need more evidence AI can handle life or death decisions. For 25 million Americans without health insurance, ChatGPT might be the closest thing to a second opinion they could afford, said Jackie Snow in Quartz. But as we've seen with AI therapy, people have begun to form inappropriate attachments to their always-on, always-agreeable chatbots that can spiral out of control. And now these tools want to become your health advisor. AI skeptics seem to think everybody is receiving high-quality mainstream care, said Matthew Allen in the Salt Lake Tribune. Seriously? Real health care is often characterized by long wait times and brief transaction-focused visits, followed by an eye-watering bill. AI can help. Patients in Utah can now have routine prescriptions renewed by AI that reviews their medical history and safety profile. It's not without risks, but the alternative is a status quo that is failing too many patients. Waiting until some mythical state of perfection is achieved is unreasonable and counterproductive, said Dr. Robert Wachter in the New York Times. These tools provide immediate and comprehensive answers to complex questions far more effectively than a traditional textbook or a Google search. There must be sensible regulations to ensure accuracy and effectiveness. But healthcare is desperate for transformation, and AI can support it. And we'll get some of the short notes and other things on the Talking Points page. Between January 1st and January 18th, at least six people died while being held in ICE detention facilities. Three died at the Fort Bliss facility in Texas, including Cuban immigrant Geraldo Lunos Campos, 55, who suffered asphyxia due to neck and torso compression while being restrained by guards, according to the county medical examiner. In 2025, 32 people died in ICE facilities, up from 11 in the last year of the Biden administration. The National Park Service has removed an exhibit on slavery at Independence National Historic Park in Philadelphia. In accordance with President Trump's executive order on restoring truth and sanity to American history, the panels memorialized nine people enslaved by Washington at the President's House site, where the first president once lived. The U.S. has lost about 68,000 manufacturing jobs since the start of President Trump's second term. Economists link the decline to Trump's tariffs, which have raised input costs. The National Association of Manufacturers estimates that 91% of U.S. manufacturers use imported materials or parts. Homicides fell 21% last year from 2024, the largest one-year drop on record. The resulting murder rate may be the lowest since 1900, according to a study by the Council on Criminal Justice, which analyzed data from 40 large U.S. cities. On the poll watch, 65% of voters say a middle-class lifestyle is out of reach for most people. 67% say they struggle to pay for health care, and 54% say housing has become unaffordable. Nearly 60% said they worry about affording the very basics, rent, gas, routine bills, and groceries. 11% say they can't even afford the basics. 12% of U.S. workers say they use artificial intelligence in their jobs every day, an 8-point increase since 2023. 26% say they use AI at work a few times a week. And we've got time for two different quotes to finish out the show. Author Willa Cather says, "Success is never so interesting as struggle, not even to the successful." And H.L. Mencken, quoted in Goodreads, says, "A cynic is a man who, when he smells flowers, looks around for a coffin." And with that, we have run out of time again for today's episode of The Week Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.